You're with John Cleary on Sunday Night.
Good to have you with us on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Luke Geary joins us now from Salvos Legal. And we're going to take Luke on a little nostalgia trip tonight, as well as getting involved in some fairly serious stuff. Refugee policy. The government's announced a program of changes in order to deal with both the politics of the issue and the personal human tragedies involved in the issue. Luke's somebody who's come to that whole question through personal human tragedies. Luke Geary, Salvos Legal actually got its start through dealing with refugee issues.
Yeah, John, we've been doing refugee law as part of our practice now for about 7 years. It all started, I guess, out in Auburn in Western Sydney, where there was a huge African population reasonably recently resettled and who were separated from their families at the time. And there's no service available at that time for those persons to be able to reunite with them. And so the Salvation Army saw a great need to keep these families whole or to reunite them. And we thought we would venture into that area of the law. And after some many thousands of cases now, we've seen a lot of happy reunited families. So parents who've now got their children once again, or spouses, or even children who were thought to be orphans, have found, after some years of searching, found a parent or parents who are in fact living and were able to send for them.
Were there any common threads that you could identify through those thousands of cases that strike you as things that really needed to be dealt with appropriately by government?
Yeah, I guess a lack of reliable documentation was very much a common thing. These are families or individuals, even children sometimes, who leave a situation of incredible trauma, the sorts of things that you would never want anyone close to you to ever have to be a witness to. They leave them in the immediacy of the moment. They don't think, well, where's my passport? Where's my identification? Where's my wallet? All those sorts of things. They just run. And then, obviously, as they come to Australia, or they start the process to come to Australia through the UNHCR, the United Nations, or through some other means, they have issues of identification difficulties, so people needing to confirm their name, their date of birth, where they're from, their age, biological relationships with people. These sorts of things compound on them, and it just makes the whole process so much more complicated.
Any of the cases that you've dealt with been people who've come through that worst of all possible routes, that is, through the boats, the risk of death, and getting here and in a situation where really Australia has proved their physical salvation. That is, if they'd been left where they were, they would have been killed.
I've got a great, very close relationship. One of our lawyers, in fact, at Salvos Legal, she's from Sierra Leone. She's both a nurse and a lawyer. Her husband as well, he's a doctor up in Queensland. So these are two fairly young people now, under 30, who have come to Australia as a second home from a situation of a war-torn country. And as refugees, they've made an immediate go of their lives and are just giving back into the communities, both in voluntary capacities and as part of their ordinary work. So those sorts of tales are not exceptional. They are the sorts of things where people who are given an opportunity and have that determination behind them really, really do demonstrate their capabilities.
Let's talk then more specifically about what the government is proposing. It's taken the Houston report and it's laid out an agenda for what needs to happen. The general consensus seems to be in the community. Something needed to happen to prevent boats coming. And that something needed to be a sufficiently punitive regime to discourage people from daring to make that dangerous journey. The refugee community and many of those associated with the churches are saying, look, there's a real danger here because the risk you run, albeit, yes, we do need to discourage those dangerous journeys where people die, but the risk is you could be creating just as many dangers on the other side. That must be a terribly difficult path to tread, to try and thread.
Yeah, well, the two changes that the government has announced so far, one is that the offshore processing will commence in Manus Island and in Nauru. That law has passed as part of an amendment to the Migration Act, and it is in fact law now. That was one of the recommendations as an alternative to what was called the Malaysia solution, which the High Court struck down not too long ago. The other thing, so that's, I guess, one fairly controversial outcome from the Houston report. The other one, though, is one which I think a lot of people embrace, which is an increase to the humanitarian program to include up to 20,000 application places per year. And the Houston report hoped that in 5 years it might get up to, I think, as many as 27,000. So you have two outcomes, one controversial and one very positive. Certainly the two have crossover aspects of them, because one of the things that the Houston report referred to was something called the no advantage principle, which was their determination that those people who come to Australia through boats or who are part of what's called an irregular maritime arrival, not being entitled to get ahead of people who they otherwise considered were, I suppose, in the queue, I suppose how a lot of people perceive it. It's got a lot of complicated effects there, John. Even though the application program may expand to include, say, 20,000 persons, for those people who come here and are part of that no advantage principle, well, you're going to see a lot of families which will never, in fact, be able to be reunited, notwithstanding any amount of time.
That must be an almost inconceivable burden to thrust on people.
Well, you think about the psychological effect of, say, a husband or a wife leaving children or each other under the assumption that they'd be able to send for them when they get here. And when they get here and Australia agrees that they are, in fact, refugees, people who Australia owes a protection obligation under international and local law, and those individuals have these very huge barriers placed in front of them to be able to reunite with their family. And these are things like the very high costs of lodging applications under the family stream of migration, or difficulties in providing sponsorship obligations, the time periods, let alone forgetting the time periods that it would take for these people to be able to come here, just the hurdles in terms of those other barriers are things which will probably prove to be insurmountable for many people.
And of course, these barriers, because they're designed to prevent the boats coming, or hopefully prevent the boats coming, don't apply to those who fly in and overstay visas or whatever other means they use to get here.
Yeah, there's no aspect of the amendments to the legislation, John, which affects people who arrive here and make a claim for protection once they are here. So those people who arrive here by plane are not brought into this aspect of offshore processing.
So it's not about the merits of protection per se.
It's really about the punitive aspect of the boats. Yeah, it's the means of arrival which will classify someone as either going over to Manus Island or Nauru, or having their claims determined whilst they're here in the community.
It would seem that anybody who does have the money would prefer to come by plane than
Some countries, though, I guess you'll never have a chance of being able to get here by plane, because you're in a high risk of being a person to make a claim.
So the immigration department can't walk across the tarmac at an airport and put your passport in and get on board the plane.
Australia simply won't.
So those who are coming by boats tend to be those who are most desperate.
The most desperate, yes. The most desperate in all circumstances.
There are a number of things that the Houston report said which have to be clarified too, that aren't quite straightened out, are they not?
Yeah, John, there's a number of things that the government has said it's going to do, and which we're still waiting to see some of the detail on, as a matter of the protections for ensuring the treatment and the standards for persons who are subject to the offshore processing regime. These are things like making sure that the treatment is consistent with human rights standards.
Well, the UNHCR has already stepped back from that, haven't they, just in the last few days?
Yeah, they've
basically said, well, look, we're not sure that we can really...
Well, they said that they're not going to be a participant in the process, and Australia can can conduct itself independently of the UNHCR. They're not going to be there to oversight it. They didn't say that they condemn it, of course. They simply said that they didn't feel that they needed to be a part of that process. But I think as time goes on, there'll probably be a need for the UNHCR to make certain inspections of facilities and to look at the processes that are put in place. But we simply don't have enough detail yet on how this is all going to work and how the individual rights of these persons are going to be protected.
Are there any specific questions for clarification that really are ones that sort of ring little alarm bells from you? You've mentioned one. But are there others in that list of six or seven?
Yeah, well, look, we know that the government is going to commit itself to making sure the physical and mental health services are available to persons in these locations, but we don't know to what standard. We know that, you know, some years ago under the former regime, when this was obviously a very highly controversial issue still, there were concerns of abuses of persons' rights in terms of having access to psychologists and doctors, and we saw some incredible things. We saw sites that hopefully we never have to see again, where children or other persons who were detained were doing things, avoiding eating food or avoiding or refusing other treatment or those sorts of things. We just don't have enough of a detail and a commitment to how these circumstances are going to be dealt with in a better way.
Because you've indirectly had to deal with those things in the past, like you've had people come under your aegis who have gone through that sort of treatment or seen it close hand, to what extent are groups like yours going to be peradventure dragged into those sorts of issues because of the people who are going to be coming through your doors? And you're going to have to then be back again saying, look, we've got to worry about the standards of treatment. We've got to worry about these sort of stuff.
I think, John, one of the big things that we're going to find is there's going to be a lot longer time periods in processing of these applications. Currently, these applications get a priority, but that's going to be removed under, again, the no advantage principle. So we're going to see that people are in detention in these offshore locations for a lot longer than they currently are. Over the past some months, the government has conducted a very widespread endeavour to have a lot of people released into community forms of accommodation. That's been a very positive thing. I think everyone who acts in an advocacy role would support that. But we're going to see the reversion back to longer detention, obviously compulsory detention.
With its psychiatric consequences.
Well, in remote locations where the facilities are obviously going to be compromised by the difficulties in providing those services in an ongoing and quality way through simply the geographical distances and the stresses that are going to be placed on them.
How far do lawyers and you as an agency can you go in those circumstances in actually trying to intervene for someone's welfare? If there's a family member who's already in the community and they've got a cousin, say, who's locked up there, they know what's going on.
Yeah, well, the communication is a difficulty, John. We currently do act for persons through and with the assistance of family members, but as they become far more remote geographically, it becomes very difficult to see what's going on. One of the things that is still an uncertainty is the provision of legal and immigration representation to persons who are going to be in these offshore locations. We don't know what regime persons will be afforded representation. We assume they're going to continue to get given government-funded representation to assist with applications and to assist with claims being made. We don't know the detail. We don't know who's going to be able to be provided over there or for what length or level of assistance. We hope that it will be a quality and an ongoing service, but we just don't know yet. Mm. And this is law now, so I guess there's some catching up that still needs to be done.
Do you envisage there's going to be a fair amount of sorting out in the law over this issue?
Yeah, well, one of the things that has been controversial over the last few years has been the extent to which persons in these situations have access to the Australian courts for appeals. It's envisaged that this is a mechanism to prevent that from taking place for the future. And so we're going to see, subject to, I guess, seeing how these claims actually start to be dealt with, but I surmise that we're going to see limited, if any, intervention by Australian courts in these types of cases. And so we're going to have to really trust and rely on the independence of those people who are assessing their claims and the independent review of them by another effectively isolated regime.
We've got about a minute left. How is this going to affect the service you deliver on the ground? Are you going to see a change in the nature of the service you've been dealing with, the way you've been dealing with
people? I hope that the clients of ours, we have many of them who are in situations where they've got family members overseas. I'm hoping that the availability of now 20,000 places in the program is going to see a lot of cases which we thought would be stalled for many years. We're hoping to see them get progressed much quicker. I guess in terms of the strategy for the future, we'll keep working on these cases and fighting for these people, but we need to be able to have them come to us, and if they're in situations where they're too far away from us, then we're going to have to figure out how we're going to get there.
Luke Geary, more challenges for us as a community to think about. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks,
once
Sean.
Again on Sunday night. We look forward to your return in a few weeks' time.